to week four of Megillat Rut. We are in Perek Aleph, first chapter. And the topic that we spent time on last week, and I want to complete this week, is the question of what were the sins of the family of Elimelech? What was it that they did wrong? And the question is important, first of all, in terms of understanding the story. What message is the story trying to give us? And also understanding how we're supposed to view the individual figures within the story. Those people who are actually in it. How do we view Elimelech? How do we view Naomi? How do we view Mahlon and Kilion, Ruth and Boaz? I'm going to be muting everybody by default. And then you can unmute as you need to ask a question or make a comment. But I want to try to reduce the background noise to the extent possible. Okay. So what we said last time was, first of all, that it's clear that the Megillah believes they've done something wrong in the way that it is presented, in the way that Naomi talks about the things that have happened to the family. And our first suggestion for what they did wrong was leaving the land of Israel. Just the fact that they left Israel was unjustified and apparently a grave sin. We showed that the text itself can be read to support this because we juxtapose the departure from Israel and the death of Elimelech. And Naomi will describe her bereavement, which includes the death of Elimelech, as a divine punishment. We showed the Gemara in Bava Basra that also presented this view, as well as the Rambam brings it in Hilchos Melachim. We talked about that last time when we asked, well, what's wrong with leaving Israel that it should be such a terrible sin? And we talked about the technical, we talked about the spiritual benefits of being in the land of Israel, and we then talked about whose sin this would be, on whose plate does this land, and we said certainly Elimelech. The Gemara seems to say Mahlon and Kilion as well, and then we noted that as far as Naomi, it's unclear whether this is considered a sin for Naomi or not. Generally speaking, we would assume that it was Elimelech's move and not hers. However, there is a second view supported in the Medrash that Naomi was complicit in the act despite her personal righteousness. And that was our first take. Yes, Susan J. Do you have a question? Or is that hand raised by accident? No. Okay. So, the second approach was that it wasn't just that they left the land of Israel, but it was also that they abandoned everybody else during the famine. And this is presented in two different ways. The traditional way that it's understood, the Medrash in Rut Rabbah says that they abandoned the rest of the population, meaning they didn't want to support them financially. And then also the Gemara in Bava Basra that suggests that it's that they did not pray for everybody else. So what we started with last time was to ask, how do you know that? How do you know that they were wealthy? So we showed from the text itself that they had a field. Naomi says that she was full. She had a lot of assets when she left, and now she's come back empty-handed. We talked about the shock of the citizens. We talked about the word Ephratim. We established enough of a basis to believe that they were wealthy when they left. However, what that doesn't say is how we know that they left in order to abandon everybody else. What's your basis for saying that their reason for leaving was that they did not want to help others? So if you look on your source sheet, look at source number one, please. The Medrash in Rut Rabbah that we quoted last time that said that they left because everybody was going to be coming around their doors, right? The end of the Medrash. It supports this by saying, Hahu dichsiv, like the text says, Vayelech ish mi Beit Lechem Yehuda. The man went from Beit Lechem Yehuda. It emphasizes the departure from Beit Lechem. And we have a tradition of such drashot, such analyses of the text, that when a text says somebody traveled to somewhere, we take that as normal. But if the text says somebody left point A to go to point B, then we say something else is up. Why did you mention the place that they left? And so what the Medrash is doing is it's saying, why did you emphasize they left Beit Lechem Yehuda? Because the point of their journey was not only to arrive in Moab. It was to abandon Beit Lechem Yehuda. That's the idea. Susan, you look perplexed.
I can't find it on my sheet. It says week 4.
Yeah, what do you have as source number 1?
Option 2, abandoning
yeah.
the nation.
Yeah, Medrash Root Rabbah.
I must have missed, okay.
What's on the next line after the line option 2?
Avimelech Hayav Migdolei.
Elimelech Hayav, right, that's the Medrash.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's what we're looking at. So the end of that Medrash says that the emphasis for us is on the text saying that a man left Beit Lechem. It's the fact that he left Beit Lechem Yehuda that the text is emphasizing that suggests to us that he is abandoning it. That's the idea. The Torah Tamima quotes this Medrash, Baruch Levi Epstein, and he adds a note on it. If you were to lean this pasuk, okay, the Balei Kriya here, Vayelech Ish Mi Beit Lechem Yehuda, that's the way the notes work. There's a darga on Mi Beit, and then a tevir on Yehuda, and it's like there's a pause. You heard it when I leaned it. Vayelech Ish Mi Beit Lechem Yehuda. So the Torah Tamima says, the man went from the house, bread for Yehuda. He didn't want to give bread to Yehuda. I thought that was clever. I don't think it's pshat, but I think it's clever. Okay. So basis number 1 for saying that they were abandoning everybody is because the text emphasizes where they left and not only what their destination was. But it's more than that. Why in the world would a Jew with means go during a famine to live among people who were enemies of the Jews? Right? Moab is not good. Right? They go specifically to live among Moab. Moab is not our ally in the period of the Shoftim. There are times in the period of the Shoftim when they specifically attack us, right? Like the time of Ehud ben Gera, which may be the period of the Megillah, right? Talked about when exactly in the Shoftim this story may have taken place. And Moab is not our ally in general, right? The Moabites fight us in the time of King Ahab also. The whole Mesha Stili with its record of Moabite attacks on Israeli cities. So you look at it and say, you know, this ain't going to Florida. When they go to Moab, that in and of itself is a statement. And then building on that, Moab is the prototype of selfishness in Tanakh. Moabite is known for selfishness in Tanakh. Tell me, who's the first Moabite? Nope, Rose, they're not in that, war, Rose. Sorry? What, Hannah?
The son of, what's his name, Lot.
Right, the son of Lot. Right? Lot has 2 daughters, and then he has sons with those daughters, and those sons are named Ammon and Moab. So, that son was born from Lot and his daughters, who had fled from the town of Sodom. What's the first thing we know in the Torah about Sodom?
Selfishness.
Before that. The very first thing we know about...
It's a beautiful place.
Is that... Sorry, what, Hannah?
It's a beautiful place.
It's a beautiful place. When Abraham says to Lot... Right? Abram says to Lot, they're having trouble because there's too much cattle, right? So he says, you go where you want to go, I'll go where I go. You want to go left, I'll go right. You go right, I'll go left. Whatever you like. You just choose. And Lot chooses Kol Kikar HaYarden. The entire shore of the Jordan. I'll take the entire shore of the Jordan. Abram, you can go off and be with the Philistines or something. It's mind-boggling how much land he takes for himself. Ki chula mashke, it is all irrigated. Well, right? Before God destroys Sodom, that's the first thing we know about Sodom. What's the second thing we know about Sodom?
Den of iniquity.
Nope, before that. Yeah, Rose, you're muted. Rose, you're muted. I can't hear you.
Okay, they were unwelcoming.
Nope, before that.
They were fighting the war with this.
They're not in that war. Well, they are in that war, but not that way. Yeah. What we know about Sodom is that after the war of the four kings and the five kings, the king of Sodom shows up to Avraham. Right? Remember that? The king of Sodom shows up to Avraham, and he says, Ten li anefesh v'rechush kachlach. He says, I want slaves. You can have the booty, and I want everybody that you took.
And Avraham says no.
Right? And Avraham rejects the offer.
He says no.
You have Malki Tzedek, who shows up with Avraham and gives him things, and then you have the king of Sodom, who just wants to negotiate the spoils of war. That's the nature of Sodom. Shali, shali, shalcha, shalcha. We're very focused on what we're going to get out of this negotiation. What's mine is mine, and what's yours is yours. And then, of course, Lot goes to Sodom and chooses it because it's so beautiful there, and he takes that whole area for himself. It is identified with greed, and yes, that plays out in the story of Sodom and in its destruction, and that's where Moab comes from. Remember that the Jews encounter Moab on their way into Israel, right? We talked about Moab not allowing them to go through their land. But remember also that the king of Moab, right? Balak, Melech Moab, is worried about those Jews. What is Balak worried about those Jews? What does he think those Jews are going to do?
Drink his water.
To drink his water, to take his resources, right? Rose, you were unmuted and then you're muted.
I know, sorry. And then he asks Balaam to go and curse the Jews.
Right, but what was he worried that the Jews were going to do?
And they were also going to multiply. He was worried that they were going to get
That's Paro. Paro is the multiplication one.
Okay.
The king of Moab is worried. Yelachachu hakahales kol sevivo senu. They're going to consume all of our resources. He's not worried that we're going to fight him. He's worried that we're going to take all of the resources. Moab doesn't know how to share. Moab is identified with greed, and then it's reiterated when we learn that we're not supposed to marry them because they wouldn't give us food and water, and it will come up again. Those who learned Yeshaya with me last year and the year before will recall Yeshaya chapter 16, as read by Ibn Ezra and Radak, has Yeshaya rebuke the people of Moab for selfishness, for not helping the Jews when they were refugees. So Moab is known, and Susan, I see your hand. Moab is known, going back to their roots in Sodom, as people of selfishness. Elimelech's family chooses to leave the body of the Jewish people and go to Moab. His guilt is not just leaving Israel. It's identifying with Moab as people of selfishness. We do not want to provide, as the Tartmima said, Lechem Yehuda. We do not want to provide bread for Yehuda. And once again, this can be assigned to Elimelech, Mahlon, and Kilion, but most commentators exempt Naomi and say this is not her. And note, then I'll take Susan's question. This will fit the themes that we talked about when we introduced the book, where we talked about a theme of betrayal as part of this, as part of the themes of the book. And we talked about the theme of chesed in the book. So this fits very well, because they are held responsible for having abandoned everybody else and refused to help. Susan, you've been patient. Thank you.
Okay, the reason I have just more a history question.
Yeah.
Why, like today, Jews wouldn't go to Iran particularly, because they know what they're our enemies. And Moab was a known enemy, like of all the countries to go to, why pick the enemy?
Right. No, that's exactly the question. That's the question. Why did you pick Moab? I mean, I should note, it's not like there were other neighbors who loved us. During the period of the Shoftim, there aren't too many vacation areas.
Right, but did they, so, like, but if a Jew went to, this is more history to me, if a Jew went to a land of Moab or any of the other lands, they were allowed to settle there? Like they weren't killed because it was coming in?
Yes, correct. Just like Iran.
The, I'm gonna leave Iran out of this. The, but, the, when I have someone here named Rahmani, the, I'm gonna leave Iran out of this. but,
Iranian.
No, but this is what I will say, Susan.
Yeah.
The relationship the Jews have with Moab, for the most part, is like the relationship that they have with the various non-Jewish tribes who live east of the Jordan. So think of Ammon, think of Moab. Edom is sort of there and south. That's a bigger discussion.
Rome.
But they used to raid Israel. They would come in, take what they could get from our produce, and then they would go back home. There were points where some of them, like Midian, actually tried to set up shop west of the Jordan. Because they saw we did it. We were successful. This is the way Professor Ali Tzur writes it in the Dot Mikra. They saw that we came out of the wilderness and set up shop in Canaan, and they said, hey, that's a neat trick. We want to try that too. But fundamentally, this is not about personal animosity. This is about greed.
So there's no danger for them personally to go there.
Correct. So it appears. No, because I'm still working on what Susan said, because there's another point that has to be mentioned. That's why I like it when people do the hand thing, because then it's easier to keep track. But in terms of where they could have gone, remember that we had Reuven, Gad, and Manasseh living east of the Jordan. It's not clear how long all of them last. Professor Ali Tzur is of the belief that Reuven, at some point in the period of the Shoftim, starts to disappear. And there's some basis for it. It's a longer discussion. But nonetheless, there are Jews east of the Jordan that you could have gone to. You didn't need to go to Moab. Okay. Rose, you had your hand up, and then Ricky.
No, it's fine.
Okay. Ricky.
I'm good.
Yes, Ricky.
Thank you. My arm is tired. My question is, if there's a Ra'av in Israel, wouldn't Moab also have the same conditions? Because they're not that far from where the Rav was in Israel.
Right. It's a good question. And the answer is maybe. But I don't know. The text says, Vayhi Ra'av Ba'aretz. How specific do we take Ha'aretz? Is Ha'aretz Eretz Yisrael? Is Ha'aretz the broader just land? I don't know. It's a good question in terms of the climate impact that it has west of the Jordan and east of the Jordan.
Well,
I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Would you run away from one Ra'av to another Ra'av? That's what I'm asking.
Well, you could suggest, and this is just hypothetical, but you could suggest two things. Number one, that this just highlights the fact that they're abandoning their people. Because they went from famine to famine, they just wanted to get away from the people in Beit Lechem. So that's one possibility. Another is that we showed last week that the text believes the famine is some kind of punishment. If it's only there and not in Moab, that would certainly support this possibility. Okay. It's a good question. I want to take a third approach as to what was going on here, what it was that they did wrong. Just making a note for myself. Okay. Third approach is what they did wrong was that they married women who were not Jewish. Marrying non-Jewish women at this stage, who are not Canaanite, was probably prohibited biblically. Biblically. We'll get into that in a moment. But certainly was viewed as a betrayal. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 4, okay, 2 and 3 were just left there from our discussion last time. I figured I had room on the sheet, might as well leave them in. But if you take a look at source number 4, I referenced 2 psukim for you. You have your Tanakh, because you had in the email my request to please make sure you have a Tanakh. Take a look, please, at Shmot chapter 34, sentence 16. Where did mine go? Oh, here it is. Shmot chapter 34, sentence 16. Okay?
correct. This text talks about not worshiping idols. Then it talks about not making a covenant with the dwellers of the land who follow their gods. Because what's going to happen is they are going to call you to eat from their offerings. And that's where sentence 16 begins. You'll end up taking from his daughters for your sons. Their daughters are going to follow their gods. And they're going to get your sons to follow their gods as well. Now, that text is clearly a warning against marriage with idolaters. However, it's not framed there as a prohibition until you get to Deuteronomy chapter 7. That's my other reference there in source number 4, Devarim Perek Zion, Deuteronomy chapter 7, sentences 1 to 4. At least I hope it's 1 to 4. I think it was working from memory there. The chapter 7. Yep, there you go. When Hashem, your God, brings you into the land that you are coming to settle that land, right? You see that? He is going to get rid of all these nations before you, these seven nations. He's going to put them into your hands, right? This is, remember, I've discussed on other occasions, Rav Kook says the goal was not to destroy the seven nations. The goal was to convince them to come to serve God as Noahites, that they should keep the seven laws that apply to all human beings. That was the goal. However, post Golden Calf, that ship sails. It isn't going to happen that way. And so therefore God says, I'm going to give them into your hands. Don't make any covenants with them. And velo sishatein bum. Do not marry them. Right? Don't give your daughter to his son. Don't take his daughter for your son. They're going to lead you into idolatry. So there it's a prohibition. But tell me, does that apply to all non-Jews? Chana shakes her head no.
The seven nations, they're going.
Right. It only states explicitly seven Canaanite nations. That leads to a debate. What, Susan?
Isn't there the halacha thing where from a specific thing you learn a clone?
So that would not work here. Meaning what Susan is talking about is the idea that when you have a klal, you can then expand to other cases within the set. But that would have been if you said to to idolaters, let's say. Here it enumerated very specific tribes. You can't expand from there to others who are not of those tribes. However, take a look at source number 5, which brings you the debate. The debate is basically which part of the sentence are you supposed to emphasize? Are you emphasizing the part of the sentence that says the Canaanite nations, or are you emphasizing the part of the text that says because they're going to lead you to worship idols, right? If you emphasize just the Canaanites, then it's just the Canaanites. If you emphasize it's going to lead to idolatry, then it's all the nations that worship something other than the Jewish God. So you take a look at source number 5, you see the Machlokas and the Gemara. The Gemara there is talking about the possibility that intermarriage is rabbinic, and it says, what do you mean? Intermarriage is biblically prohibited. You can't marry the daughters of the nations. The text says, don't marry them. To which the first view presented is, no, De'oraisa Zion Umos. The biblical prohibition is only the seven Canaanite nations. The rest of them are not biblically prohibited until the rabbis come along and prohibit them. However, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai disagrees, and he says, no, anyone who is not Jewish is going to be within this prohibition. So you have such a debate. But Eve, first of all, just to know, we follow Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Intermarriage is a biblical prohibition, whether Canaanite or otherwise. Ezra seems to follow that also, but that's a discussion from back from when we learned Ezra together. But everybody agrees, for sure, that marrying somebody who was not of the Jewish people was considered an act of betrayal long before Ezra came along. And long before even before this text in Deuteronomy, right? Rivka's statement, I don't want my son marrying a Canaanite, right? That's long ago. Whole discussion about why Abraham doesn't want Yitzchak to marry a Canaanite, that's its own discussion, not for right now. But I brought you the text from Malachi, because I thought this was actually a good example. Take a look, please, at source number 6. I referenced for you verses from Malachi, for the end of Nevi'im, the end of the prophets. Okay, Malachi chapter 2. Okay? I'm muting people by default, just because of background noise. Unmute when you need to make a comment, please. Malachi chapter 2 brings a stinging, stinging rebuke of Jewish men who had taken wives from the nations around them. And if you look at sentence 11 specifically, Bagda Yehuda, V'soeva ne'esta b'Yisrael u'v'Yerushalayim. Yehuda has committed treason. Something abhorrent has been done in Yisrael and Yerushalayim. The Kichilel Yehuda Kodesh Hashem Asher Ahev. Yehuda has desecrated the sanctuary of God that he loved. Uva'al Bas El Nechar. He has been with the daughter of a foreign god. That's not about Canaanites. By the time Malachi says this, we don't even know who the Canaanites are anymore. This is post-Assyria, post-Sancherev. So that marrying a woman who was not Jewish, which Mahlon and Kilion seem to have done, is, if not prohibited biblically, still an act of betrayal. Clear? Got it? Okay. Now, here we need a bit of a clarification. Just briefly, Malbim takes his time on this, and it's nice of him to do so. I'm going to do it without his text. Tell me something. Who married whom? Which one married which one? Don't look at source number 8, because if you look at source number 8, that's cheating. Susan, you're muted.
I remember because the one who came, David came from we discussed it now, it's not which one, but I know.
David comes from neither son. I'm asking you, Ruth and Arpa marry Mahlon and Kilion. Which one married which?
Mahlon married Ruth.
How do you know?
At the end, it says, Lakim Shemameh.
Good. If you go to chapter 4, sentence 10 in Ruth, it's surprising. I never thought about it until I started trying to unpack this. It doesn't say it in chapter 1. It's only in chapter 4 that Ruth was identified as Eshet Mahlon, the wife of Mahlon. That's how you know. You see it? Ruth married Mahlon. It seems clear, though, in chapter 1, sentence 2, that which one is older, Mahlon or Kilion? Which one is older? Mahlon, right?
Mahlon.
So Ruth married the older one, right? Ruth married Mahlon, the older one. Now look at sentence 4, where we're told that Mahlon and Kilion married Moabite women. The first one was Arpah, the second one was Ruth. So the Malbim says that what happened was, whoever's got a phone dinging, please, if you could silence it, thanks. The Malbim assumes that first the younger brother Kilion married Arpah, and then the older brother Mahlon married Ruth. And that's going to matter in the Malbim's assessment of the brothers' personalities, which I'm going to come back to very shortly. But what happens is first Arpah and Kilion get married, and then Ruth and Mahlon get married. Got it? You with me? Right now you don't know why this matters. Hang in there, we'll find out. But who is, I'm assuming right now that Ruth and Arpah did not convert before marrying Mahlon and Kilion. I'm gonna come back to that, but that's my assumption right now. If that's true, then obviously Mahlon and Kilion are to be blamed for it, and the Gemara in Bava Basra blames them for it, as the Gemara is read by the Maharsha. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 9 and source number 10, in source number 9, I brought you a passage from Divrei Hayamim, from Chronicles. I'm not sure why I decided to include this verse from Tanakh on the sheet, where in general I don't include the verses, but for some reason I did. Along with a translation, there are a lot of names. It was a good exercise for my spell check. So the text here in Divrei Hayamim in Chronicles is listing the descendants of Shelah, son of Yehuda. and it mentions a man named Er. This is not Er from Bereishit. Er was Shelah's brother. He could be named for Er. But there was Er, the father of Lecha. There was Lada, the father of Maresha, and so on in the line. And along the way, it mentions these descendants of Yehuda, Yoash and Saraf, Asher Ba'alu Limoav. Yoash and Saraf, Asher Ba'alu Limoav. So the Ba'alu, according to Radak, means they fought with Moav. They conquered Moav. However, that's not the way the Gemara understands it. The Gemara understands, like JPS, interestingly, that Ba'alu means they married Moabites. Yoash and Saraf are descendants of Yehuda who married Moabites. So the Gemara says, I don't know descendants of Yehuda who married Moabites, other than Machlon and Kilion. Yoash and Saraf are Machlon and Kilion. That's interesting. That's a very interesting thing. We talked last time about names in Tanakh. And I think we mentioned, Machlon means what? We think it means?
Disease, illness.
Sickness. We're going to come back to another way to look at the names, but that's what it sounds like right now. And Kilio means destruction, right? Vayechulu, Kila. And then on the other hand, we have Yoash and Saraf. Yoash, Yeush, means?
Despair,
right. Abandonment of hope. Yeah. Saraf means?
Burned.
Consumed in fire. So this set of names is not an upgrade for them. The Yoash and Saraf sound an awful lot like Machlon and Kilion to me. So take a look at source number 10 in the Gemara. The Gemara says, Ksiv Machlon v'Kilion, Uchsiv Yoash v'Saraf. The text says Machlon and Kilion, and the text says Yoash and Saraf. Why do I have different names for them? So Rav and Shmuel had a debate. One of them said, I'm just going to read my English translation here, but you could see the original in the Gemara as well. One of them said, Machlon and Kilion are their real names. The text in Divrei HaYamim calls them Yoash and Saraf to say Yoash, despair, because they despaired of redemption. Saraf, because they were liable for death, for burning. That's the first view. The other view says, no, Yoash and Saraf were the real names. Well, then why is it that they're called Machlon and Kilion in Megillat Rut? Machlon, not Machala, illness, but rather Sha'asu Gufan Chulin. They made their bodies mundane, and Kilion, they were liable for destruction. So that's the key phrase, making their bodies mundane. What does that mean? Writes the classic commentator Maharsha, for marrying Moabite women. That's what they, that's why they're liable. They're desecrating themselves. By marrying these Moabite women.
This is a very good lashon because the Bat Kohen who married somebody else is Tachel.
Right.
So it's the same in Shoresh.
Right. Et Avia Himechalelet. Right. Good point. If you take a look at source number 11, the Malbim now it analyzes the marriages. I already gave you his presentation about who married whom, right? So take a look at the Malbim here in number 11. The Malbim is fascinated by the fact that the text in Rut emphasizes and spells out what each one was named and who they married. He says it explained that one was named Orpah and one was named Ruth for two reasons. It's really not just that it's one was named. I translated that inappropriately. That the first was named Orpah, and that the second one was named Ruth. That's really the key point. For two reasons. One, Kilion, the younger brother, went first and took Orpah and began the sin, demonstrating that the brothers lacked refinement. The younger married before the firstborn, and the older brother did not protest. Who is the Malbim Paskining like from Chumash?
Sorry?
Lavan. No, like Lavan, not like Yaakov. He's paskening like Lavan. He's saying it's wrong for the younger one to be married before the elder. This is actually a fascinating discussion because there are sources in Jewish law that say that it's true that the younger one should not marry before the older. As a matter of halachic practice, we say that whoever's ready to get married and finds the right person should. However, if there are two siblings who are ready to get married at the same time, then it's true. Priority goes with the elder out of respect for the elder. But we wouldn't say to a younger sibling, you have to hold off while your older sibling is looking for a shidduch. That would not be appropriate. There's a nice, interesting discussion of this in a few different places. Sorry, what, Ricky?
We know Orpah. It's a biblical name,
Orpah. Orpah. Two different things. Ophrah is also a biblical name, but that's not the same as the name Orpah. So the first point he makes, and this is why I took the time to spell out who married whom, is that the first marriage is the one of the younger brother Kilyon marrying Orpah, and he views that as a lack of good manners, a lack of proper culture, that the younger gets married before the elder. But then he also goes on and says, it's more than that. I'm reading out of my translation. If Mahlon had married first, there would have been some justification for both of them. Because Mahlon married Rut, who was good. So you could say what happened was, right, this is like the two chimney sweeps, and one's clean and one's dirty, right? So he says, look, Mahlon, I'm going to say it outside the text. Mahlon finds Rut, and he's really impressed, because Rut is a wonderful person. Back when she was a Moabite, she was a wonderful person. So Mahlon jumped up and said, I'm marrying Rut. And then along came Kilyon, and he said, well, you found a great Moabite girl. I'm going to try to marry a Moabite girl also, and maybe she'll be good too. That would have made sense had that been what happened. But it wasn't what happened. Rut married second. The first marriage was Kilyon and Orpah. So therefore, you don't have the justification at all. And if anything, Kilyon married Orpah first and got a bad, match. We're going to talk about Orpah later on, maybe today, maybe next week. But then Mahlon should have not married Rut, because he should have seen what happened with his brother. Yes, Rose.
So you're saying that he married Orpah, but originally, Orpah offered to go with Naomi. So, and then Naomi says to her, don't come.
Right, so.
So how bad was she?
So I'm getting to that, but not this week, likely. Okay. That's what I said. I'm going to have to get to, God willing, next time. But I did put it in sources 21 and 22 on the sheet today. But I knew when I did it that we weren't going to get to it. I just included it anyway.
Do we know how old the brothers were when they left Israel?
Nope. We do not have enough information. The only thing that we do know is that the Gemara blames them as part of the departure, making it sound like they were adults. But we don't know anything beyond that. We just don't have the information. So some people even read. Yes, Rose. You have to unmute. I had muted you when I talked to Joyce.
So one last thing. Naomi somehow doesn't get as bad a thing as everybody else. Why?
So
kind of excluded, and yet you said last week that she actually was just as culpable because she agreed to go and she was part of the deal.
Right, so what I said last week was that most commentators believe that she's not guilty, but there are some midrashim which do assign blame to her. Generally, we assume not, and in large part, we assume not for two reasons. Number one, the bad decisions we've described so far really are associated with the males. And number two, because we see her conduct in the rest of the book. She's presented in a very positive light. She assigns guilt to herself. She says, God did this to me and I'm being punished and so on. But the book doesn't really seem to assign that to her.
She redeems herself somewhat.
At least somewhat.
Conceding to her own guilt.
At least somewhat. Some read the guilt of Mahlon and Kilyon into their very names in a very interesting way. We saw the Gemara in source number 10 that suggested that Machlon and Kilion may not be their real names and are instead being used in the text in order to criticize them. That raises an interesting question. Does that mean that Naomi gave them terrible names? Right? You name your kid illness and destruction, you can't really be surprised when problems ensue. Right? I always wonder about that with Yosef. Rachel names Yosef, God should give me another kid. Like, seriously? Or God has gathered in my shame. Take your pick. But that's what you're seeing here. It sounds like, but we're going to see a different view. Before we see the different view, yes, Hannah?
I think grammatically, if Machlon would name sickness, it wouldn't be Machlon, because it's not Machla, it's Machala. By the way, there's a name Machla, which is similar to Machlon.
So we're getting there. We're getting there.
It should be Machalon if it was for sickness.
I hear you. I don't know, the chet is always very tricky in that regard, but you could have had a chet of patach, it's true.
But in Machala, it's not a chet of patach. It's
really? Well, how could it be? Can a chet have a straight patach?
Asher
Santi b'Mitzrayim, right, that's a straight patach? I'm gonna look it up, cause when you have a CD, you might as well,
how do we know how to pronounce it?
Hang on one second. I just want to see Kol HaMachala.
It could be Machalon instead of Machlon. How do we know to pronounce it without?
Hang on. We know it's a Shva instead of a Chatav Patach.
There's nothing in the Bible.
No, but we have a Masorah for how to pronounce it. We have the Masoretic text. Okay. Here we go. I'm looking at Kol HaMachala. It's a Chatav Patach, Hannah. Sorry. It's a chatav patach. But in any case, Ibn Ezra says they're named Machlon and Kilion not to be named death and destruction, you know. Their reason is something must have happened around the time that they were born, and this was meant to be associated with that. That's Ibn Ezra. But look at source number 12, where I brought you Professor Meltzer in his commentary on the second pasuk in Rut. And he says, you're going down the wrong path. And even though I retyped all the Hebrew for you so that you'd have it, I'm just going to work with my English translation in the interest of time. He says, in explaining these names, one should distinguish between their origin and their end, meaning why the name was given at birth versus how Machlon and Kilion lived their lives. In their origin, they didn't mean illness and destruction. We have seen the name Machala with the daughters of Tzlofchad as well, right? One of Tzlofchad's daughters was named Machala. We have had numerous men in Tanakh named Machli, right? Machli Umushi as one example. And we have found numerous women named Machalat. And we have found places named Mechola and Avel Mechola in Tanakh. They may be connected to the expression Machol, which is either dancing or a musical instrument, perhaps a tambourine. But it is possible, right, when you think of Miriam, Betupim uvimacholot, after the sea. But it is possible that the main meaning of the name is sweet, as is indicated by the root chet lamed vav in Arabic. This would resemble the meaning of their mother's name, Naomi, which means pleasant. So he says there are all sorts of other explanations. Machlon does not have to mean disease. It could mean a dance, it could mean a tambourine, it could mean sweet. And then he says, as far as the name Kilion, one should not see the concept of destruction in its origin. In the root kaf lamed hey, one can hear in the language of scripture the meanings of completion. Right? Kala doesn't have to be destroyed. It can mean complete. And fullness. As we hear regarding the completion of the construction of the Beit HaMikdash, the house was completed, kala, in all of its ways. So he says, not so fast. Don't pick on the names necessarily. Okay, fine. Elimelech can't really be blamed for it because it seems to be after Elimelech died, although it does go back to Elimelech's decision to move the family to Moab. One question which we're not really going to discuss here, but I'm just throwing it out there, is did Rut and Orpah do anything wrong by marrying these Jewish men? Have they done anything wrong by marrying Jewish men who aren't supposed to marry them?
They got an upgrade.
That's not fair to them. They don't know our laws.
So I'll tell you something. I'm going to say two things. Number one, we're going to come back to, not today, I think, but we're going to come back to a possible argument that Naomi blames them for the loss of her sons. This I saw in Dr. Ziegler. She's the one who floats that idea, if I remember correctly. There's something in the text may indicate that Naomi blames them. But also, think about how Jewish families work, right? When a son comes home with a non-Jewish love interest, right? People often will blame the non-Jewish love interest. You see it. I mean, I'm not talking about halacha. I'm talking about just the way people live their lives. So just, you know, something to think about, something to keep in mind. But I made an assumption before, and I want to revisit it now. I see somebody laughing, but I don't know if she wants me to call your attention to it. I made an assumption that there was no conversion by Rut and Orpah. That, in fact, is the view of the Medrashim. I'm not making it up. Most obviously, the Gemara in Yevamos in source number 13, which we're not going to go through in depth right now. We're going to have to come back to it. But this Gemara in Yevamos analyzes the speech that Ruth gives to Naomi and sees in it a conversion, right? On the way back, when Naomi says, stay, you should stay, you should stay, and Ruth says, no, I'm going with you, and she says, your nation is my nation, your God is my God, and all of that, the Gemara sees that as a prototype for conversion, which means that she hadn't converted beforehand. No conversion could have happened earlier. The story wouldn't make any sense. And that was the view of the Gemara regarding Yoash and Saraf in source number 10, right? By talking about him making his body mundane, desecrating, right? By marrying her, obviously the assumption is that in fact she's not Jewish at that point. Also take a look at source number 14, the Medrash Tanchuma on Parshat Behar. Vayomos Elimelech Ishna Ami. Elimelech, husband of Naomi, died. So the Medrash asks, "V'lo haya levanav lilmod me'aviyam lachzer le'eretz Yisrael?" Why didn't Mahlon and Kilion figure out that they should go back to Israel when this happened to their father? Uma asu, and what did they do? Afheim nasu lem nashim o'aviyo. They even married Moabite women, and the Medrash says explicitly, "Shelo hitbilu otam v'lo giru otan." They didn't go to mikvah. They did not convert. So the Medrash is very clear on this point. No conversion has taken place at this stage. Not only that, the Malbim says something fascinating in support of this. Take a look, please, at source number 15. I love the Malbim. He has all sorts of things to say that nobody else says. He picks up on names here. He says, "Vihine." Habanim hosifu lachto bameshenas unashim o'aviyot shelo giru otan. He says the sons continued to sin. They added on sin. They by marrying Moabite women who had not been converted, as we just saw in the Medrash. Valze amar, and so it says shem ha'achat arpa. He says the name of the first one was Arpa. Because if they had converted, they would have taken new names. By saying her name is Orpah, you're saying she kept her original name of Orpah. The assumption is Orpah is not a Jewish name. Orpah was the name she started with and that she retained. And then in brackets, he says something which is very interesting. There's a Gemara in Brachos which talks about the name Rut and asks, why is it that her name is Rut? What is the meaning of the name Rut? And the answer is, David descended from her, Sheriva l'Hakadosh Baruch Hu, he quenched God's thirst with, or he satisfied God with, Tehillim, with songs and praises. So Malbim says, the name Rut was the name she had when she wasn't Jewish. The name Rut was given to her by her parents when she was born. And he says, Ruth did not change her name when she converted. And that's what the Gemara means when it asks, what is the meaning of the name Ruth? That's exactly what the Gemara is asking. What is the meaning of the name Ruth, because she shouldn't have kept her name. If she converted, she should have changed her name. So what the Malbim is trying to say, and this is a little bit all over the place, so let me see if I can concentrate it. What Malbim is saying is, the fact that they retain their names that they had from the start of the story demonstrates that they have not converted. Ruth will continue with her old name even after she does convert, because it has special prophetic significance. That's what Malbim is suggesting. And then he continues to say, also, the verb used in the text for Mahlon and Kilion marrying them is vayis'u instead of vayikhu. That's not the verb that we usually use for marrying a Jewish marriage. Vayis'u, he says, is a term for non-Jewish marriage, which is very funny because we call marriage halachically nisu'in. Nonetheless, it's the comment Malbim makes, and I don't want to analyze him too far because I'm not sure I agree. But the point in any case is that everybody here assumes that Rut and Orpah are not Jewish when Mahlon and Kilion marry them. Yes, Ricky.
Perhaps they didn't marry. Vayikhu could also be a physical act rather than a ceremonial act.
So, first of all, it's Vayis'u, not Vayikhu. There's a major problem with saying that they did not have a bona fide marriage. I'm gonna, in the interest of time, I'll just tell you. The problem with saying that it was they weren't actually married is that then there's no ge'ula, there's no redemption to do in chapter 4. If they didn't marry them, they have no claim to the fields, they have no claim to anything. Right? So that wouldn't work. But that does lead me to two challenges in saying that they didn't convert. Number one, if they didn't convert, then the marriage has no legitimacy in Judaism. So why was there any issue of marrying the widow? The same question I just put to Ricky, right? If I'm saying that they weren't Jewish, the marriage was not halachically recognized. So why does Boaz or Ploni Almoni need to marry Ruth? Right? There was no marriage from a halachic standpoint. The marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew is not recognized. So the answer I will give you is to bring you Ramban. Ramban says in source number 16, this was not a mitzvah of Yibum. Yibum, as a halacha, we know it's not. Right? Because Yibum is specifically the brother of the deceased. Boaz and Ploni Almoni are not brothers to Mahlon and Kilion, they're brothers to Elimelech, their father. He says what was going on was called Ge'ula, and it was an old practice, not the same thing as Yibum. It was done in order to take in a woman from the family. That was what was done. And apparently, this would be done even if she wasn't Jewish in this case. Taking in Ruth, who is now Jewish, right? By the time Boaz gets around to it, she is Jewish. But she would be taken into the family with Ge'ula. That's number one. But I have a different problem. And I don't have an answer to this problem. I don't know if there is a possibility, really. But take a look in the text at the conversation between Ruth and Naomi, between Ruth and Orpah and Naomi, when they want to come back with her, right? In Pasuk Chet, in sentence number 8, right? Naomi says to them, go back, each of you should go back to your mother's house, right? And God should perform kindness with you as you performed and so on. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why does that not bother us? As you know, you're telling them that they should go back and they should return to their people. I mean, I guess you could ask this question both ways. It's also a problem if they converted. It's a problem either way. You know, sort of a question of how is it that you're sending them back to go be Moabites? I rescind my question. You could really ask the question both ways. Rose, I see that you have your hand up, but I just want to finish this point first, okay? There is another view that says that they converted first, that they converted in the beginning of the story. And I think you could sustain it, first of all, from the fact that the text always identifies them as Moaviot, not Nochriot. Moabites, not non-Jews. That's number one. But number two, Ibn Ezra says, these are leading people. If you take a look at source number 17, Ibn Ezra says, Lo yitachein, it can't be that Mahlon and Kilion would have married these women before they converted. He says, it can't be. And so he says, the text says, that when Arpa leaves, she went back, El Amah ve'el Eloheha, to her nation and to her God. Meaning, she had converted to Judaism, is the default, and now she's going to go back to being a Moabite. Which again, bothers me, because how could Naomi send her back to being a Moabite after she converted to Judaism? I feel like that's a terrible thing to do. The question I was asking before. But that's the view of Ibn Ezra, that they had actually converted first. You can suggest that maybe there was some kind of a conversion that happened. We've talked about elsewhere the idea that there could have been a conversion that took place with three Jews without it being a formal high-level rabbinical court. We talked about that with Shimshon and the Philistines as well. Rose, yes. You have to unmute. Yeah.
My question is, assuming that they hadn't converted, because we said Orpah had not, where does Ruth actually convert prior to this?
So, no, the idea is, what Ibn Ezra believes, is that conversion occurred for both of them prior to.
Yes, but we said, assuming it hadn't been.
Oh, assuming it had not been? Right, so assuming it had not been, Ruth makes her statement to Naomi on the road going back into Israel.
Then
when they get to Beit Lechem, has to be, taken care of ritually, so to speak. Susan, okay. You were going to ask?
No, I was going to say, that here it says, they say is Malvi, for we intend to remain with you among your people. They did not say to your God, meaning that they would convert, but merely to your people.
Yes.
In other words, to get married to a Jew, but not because they believe in Judaism. So that may answer also why Naomi didn't want them, if that's what they had said, because they didn't intend to convert legitimately.
Maybe. And there's more to that Malbim, but yes.
Okay, I just
know. Yeah.
Chana. I recall that there was something in the Gemara about Emat Baalehem, that the conversion was maybe similar to the Shomronim or the Kutim, who converted out of fear.
So
and that's a doubtful thing. So it's sort of a conversion not always accepted. And I think that if they converted because Emat Baalehem first, then now the Emad Balahen is gone, they're not converted anymore. And now, after that, Ruth actually does it willingly.
So I'm not, I'm not familiar with such a source. I'd like to see it.
Emad Balahen Alehen, I remember that.
The Gemara in Yevamos does not bring it, so I can take a look around and see if I can find where that comes from. If you can find something also, where you saw it, but I'm not familiar with that. Okay. And yeah, Susan, I'm going to take a look at that Malbim that you mentioned. Maybe I'll use it next time because it's already 2:30. But we still have to go through one last possibility, which is that the sin that they committed was specifically marrying Moabite women. But the bottom line here is that that a third approach to their sin is that they married Canaanite women not having converted. But this is hard to accept in the narrative. And the reason I say it's hard to accept is not just Ibn Ezra saying they wouldn't have done it, but also because the book doesn't make any issue of it. Meaning in Shoftim, when Shimshon marries a Philistine, it makes headlines, right? His parents say it's a betrayal, how could you do it? In Sefer Ezra, right? Ezra is up in arms about intermarriages. Here, they get married and they die 10 years later. There's no reference to it being, such a horror. So I find it to be difficult to say that this is what they did wrong. So we still have to come back to the fourth view, which is marrying Moabite women specifically, and that is what will conclude the discussion of their sin. Then we get to talk about Orpah, good person, bad person, and Naomi's refusal of their conversion. There's a lot going on in this chapter. So God willing, that will be next week. Thank you very much.